There are tears of grief, tears of anguish, and on this day, tears of joy. For the first time in 2 years, Israelis and Palestinians allowing themselves to exhale. We'll ask about the return of the last hostages with our correspondent in Tel Aviv, the return of 2,000 prisoners from Israeli jails, the ramping up of aid into Gaza, and the guns going silent. In a region used to dashed hopes, can something good come of what Donald Trump touts as a peace deal? What to make of the signing in Egypt, and the U.S. president succeeding, at least for now, where his predecessor failed. More importantly, who to deliver the alternative to all the hate and intolerance that's brought us the unbearable for more than 24 months. Today in the France 24 debate, what next after a day of emotion? With us from Tel Aviv, France 24 correspondent Noga Tarnopovsky. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, François.
From Washington, Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib, resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council think tank. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me again. Great to be with you.
Also in the U.S. Capitol, Robert Satloff, executive director of the Washington Institute think tank. Welcome to the show.
It's good to join you.
John Linden is the executive director of the Alliance for Middle East Peace, an umbrella group that brings together Israelis and Palestinians. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
You can, by the way, always listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. So many stories. Here's one. He was kidnapped on the morning of October 7th, 2023 at the Nova Music Festival. Now, 24-year-old Guy Gilboa Dalal is free. Noga Tarnopovsky, quite the story there. He was kidnapped along with his best friend from childhood.
That's right. Guy Gilboa Dalal went to this music festival with his brother, his older brother Gal, and his best friend from kindergarten, Eviatar David. And the reason for this partying from their part is that Guy, the one who was taken hostage, was about to depart for a several months long trip to India, and this was sort of their goodbye ahead of his big trip. As you said, he was 22 years old. And his brother managed to escape. Guy and Eviatar, the two kindergarten friends, did not manage and were taken hostage. One of the things we found out today is that Guy was very severely tortured in captivity. That's one of the pieces of news his family has allowed to filter through. And that he and his best friend were not kept in captivity together, but were separated and then brought together apparently for under an hour at one point several months ago, around January actually, in the time of the previous hostage prisoner exchange. They were brought together in a car driving through Gaza City for the purposes of filming a propaganda film, a Hamas propaganda film, both of them looking very wan and very weak. And now we know they were then separated again. They were reunified today in hospital after both were finally freed. Both of them very, very...
All right, we seem to have issues there with the sound at the end of that. Many thanks, Noga Tarnopovsky. Yeah, a day of high emotions among the images making the round, that of a child hoisted up to the bus carrying released Palestinian prisoners in the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. There you see that image there. Over in the West Bank, where many were released among the 1,900-plus, is France 24's Claire Pacalin. Claire, tell us about the mood where you've been.
We were in center of Ramallah earlier today when we saw two
buses draw up and Palestinian prisoners, those who were being released here in Ramallah, come out. Now, they were greeted by family members. There are also members of the Red Crescent, the Palestinian Red Crescent, as well as members of the Palestinian Security Forces, too. Now, there was obviously, as you can imagine, scenes of joy, the reunification of families, of relatives of theirs who've been in Israeli jails sometimes for many, many years. But that joy had to be somewhat contained. The families didn't stay for long. They took their relatives, these recently released prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, took them back home pretty quickly. Some of them will take them to hospital and medical clinics to get a checkup. But they didn't stay long, and they are very aware. They have all been warned by the Israeli security services not to celebrate in the street, not to in any way honor Hamas, not to do any big parties or any kind of things like that. It's very, very clear the Israelis would find that very distasteful, because among those 250 high security Palestinian prisoners who were released today, there are many who are serving life sentences, some multiple life sentences, for having carried out or organized deadly attacks against Israelis. There was another group of hostages, though, those who were released into Khan Yunis, those 1,700 or so. Those were Gazans who were detained after October 7th by the Israeli forces. So two slightly different separate groups of hostages, but of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for this hostage deal. Of course, the release of the Palestinian prisoners could only come with the release, following the release of the Israeli hostages. Once the Israeli hostages were back on Israeli soil, then the Israelis went ahead and released these Palestinian prisoners.
Yeah, and now is the question of part of that deal of the release of remains. We'll be talking about it. Claire Pakala, many thanks for that update from Ramallah. Let me ask you, Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib, have you been speaking with loved ones in the Gaza Strip this Monday?
Certainly, and there was actually, in parallel to a lot of the celebrations that people rightly had to see their loved ones, some of whom were believed to be dead among the ruins. Our own family was a little bit sad in that my sister-in-law's brother was captured in April of 2024, last year, from Hamad City in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. And we had hoped that he would actually be released today as part of the batch of 1,700 Palestinian prisoners. And he was not. And so we're hoping for a miracle of some sort. But that just underscores the pain and suffering that both Israelis and Palestinians have endured over the past 2 years. It may not be a one-for-one comparison, and I've certainly been an ally of the Israeli hostage families from October 7th onward, and that should have never, the attack should have never happened. They should have never been held in the first place. But certainly the Palestinian people and thousands of innocent Palestinians throughout the Gaza Strip paid a heavy price, some the ultimate price, for a sin that they did not commit.
On a day like this, do you allow yourself to hope?
Well, certainly that hope is the only thing that has sustained me. After all, I did also tragically lose family members. My childhood home was destroyed in Gaza. I got my siblings, some of them are still in Gaza right now. My brother runs a major medical NGO, but I got his wife and children out. I got my mom out. So this has been deeply personal. And I'm exhausted. I'm tired. I am eager to see my people having a shot at a better future. Unfortunately, as you had said in your introduction, the guns may have fallen silent when it comes to Israeli guns, but I am deeply concerned that Hamas's guns have certainly not fallen silent when it comes to retribution against the Palestinian people. I just shared images and footage of them executing dozens of Palestinians throughout the Gaza Strip. They've been reconsolidating their presence throughout the coastal enclave. We're also looking at the very real possibility that negotiations for phase two, beyond the completion of phase one and the release of hostages and prisoners, may stall or may not proceed accordingly, given that Hamas is not willing to disarm. They don't want an international security force and stabilization force. They don't want Trump's Board of Peace. And so I'm hopeful, but I'm deeply pessimistic about what lies ahead unless the same level of enthusiasm and interest and pressure on Hamas, on Netanyahu, is sustained to keep the ball rolling.
Robert Satloff, will that pressure be sustained? We heard the U.S. president, when he arrived in Sharm el-Sheikh for that signing, when asked by a reporter whether phase two, the more complicated part, the implementation of this 20-point plan moving towards a durable solution had begun. He said, yes, it had. And then later in his speech, he said, at long last, we have peace in the Middle East. What's your reaction?
Well, today is, of course, a celebratory day, and it's a day in which we are suspending some of our normal cynicism about the Middle East in order to celebrate the return of the hostages and the guns going silent, at least between Israelis and Palestinians in Gaza. I think you're absolutely right to focus on the enormous challenge of the next phase. The 20-point peace plan envisions Hamas fighters, Hamas terrorists, having to make a choice between reconciling themselves to peaceful coexistence and decommissioning their weapons, or having those weapons being taken away from them. It doesn't actually specify in any detail precisely who is doing that taking away of weaponry. This is an enormous a lacuna, an enormous challenge. There aren't going to be many militaries that are going to want to come into Gaza and forcibly disarm Hamas. And we've already seen, as we just heard, we've already seen Hamas come out of the tunnels, put on uniforms for the first time in 2 years to terrorize the people of Gaza, to take measures against anyone who even incidentally had any engagement with Israelis over the last 2 years. This is a major challenge. The Israelis have pulled behind the lines to which they were committed. Now we have to see whether or not there will be a force, a power led by the United States that will demand the implementation of this key principle: decommissioning weapons, committing to peaceful coexistence. Without this, the chance for renewed hostility is regrettably high.
John Lindzen?
Yes, I mean, the decommissioning of weapons is one of those things. I mean, the Trump plan is very thin. It's a set of principles without an awful lot of detail on how implementation will take place. We know from other conflicts that decommissioning tends to happen towards the tail end of final status discussions. And so I remain skeptical, unfortunately, that Hamas are going to be disarmed in the immediate. The one maybe disagreement I'd have with Rob is this international stabilization force, because we have heard some promising signs from Arab states, this morning from a French representative as well, about a provision of international forces. We know that senior CENTCOM officers have arrived in the region to
this could
coordinate.
Be some 200 US soldiers that'll help?
Yeah, to help to coordinate it and provide a framework. I mean, to my mind, that's not something that you do unless you're serious about a change in the security architecture in Gaza. And that could be a real game changer if done right. We've never had an international force deployed inside Gaza before. I think it would really transform the argument inside Israel for the need for sustained deployment. It would hopefully guarantee human security far, far greater than an Israeli military occupation ever could, and certainly more than Hamas military rule could. So I think we should give chance for that to be developed. All of that, though, is going to be linked to this longer-term diplomatic horizon. We know that for the Arab states to put boots on the ground and billions of dollars into reconstruction, they will require a diplomatic horizon and this pathway towards a Palestinian state. It remains the phrase I've been looking to hear mentioned today, and I've heard very little of it from President Trump, obviously from Prime Minister Netanyahu. And for me, without that there, I think you're going to find it very difficult to move from this first phase through the second and then obviously to the third. And I worry we go back to conflict management. And as Rob suggested, then the likelihood for violence is sadly very high.
Okay, so just a quick point on this, Robert Satloff, because you have seen, for instance, in the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh, lots of leaders from around the world, including the likes of Indonesia's president, who is there. And, you know, he's one of the ones who has offered to put forth Prabowo Subianto troops for an international stabilizing force. This offer of boots on the ground, is it feasible?
So it's eminently feasible, and I welcome very much the Indonesian president who suggested at the United Nations that up to 20,000 Indonesian troops could be deployed to Gaza. The question is the mission. There is a very important mission, which is human protection, namely protecting the civilians of within Gaza. But that's a very different challenge than actually disarming and decommissioning the weapons that Hamas currently has. That would require potentially direct confrontation with Hamas itself. So while there is a mission that can be fulfilled, and I expect it to be fulfilled by the Indonesians and the others that are committing gendarmerie and other forces to Gaza, it's not at all clear that they are willing to directly confront Hamas and to facilitate the taking away of Hamas weapons, which is, of course, what is required. That's what decommissioning the weapons involves. So until we know precisely what the mission is, I think we need to be a little bit hesitant about suggesting that the mere deployment of these troops, of the deployment of these stabilization forces, will do this task. There are lots of tasks to be done, but this task, taking on Hamas, this is a huge obstacle.
And there you see Prabowo Subianto speaking with Donald Trump. Those are live images, by the way, from Sharm el-Sheikh. At this point in time, Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, are we on to something? Is something changing? I'm trying to not be too cynical.
Well, I'm also, like, to be clear, I have every interest in not being cynical. I want Gaza to succeed. I want this to be a transformative moment. I'm not simply sitting here and armchairing analysis that, you know, this is bad, this won't work, etc. And as a matter of fact, I very much so believe that there's something to be said about the demeanor of President Trump, in which he was able to achieve what we didn't think was possible just a few weeks ago after the strike on Doha by the Israeli Air Force. I'm talking here about the failed attempt to assassinate Hamas leadership, which may have actually been a message all along rather than a direct attempt to go after them. We may not find out. But the point is that I don't simply want to see Gaza reconstructed. What I am really interested in is seeing the seeds of transformation, of rejuvenation, of what Tony Blair, whom I met 10 months ago, said to me, you know, Gaza needs to be reconstituted. And I actually wholeheartedly agree with that notion, in that I don't want to see the reconstruction of the destroyed refugee camps. I don't want to see the return of, the aid dependency on UNRWA, the UN, and the NGO industrial complex. I want to see the seeds of an actual sustainable economy, Gaza of the future, a digital Gaza, Gaza being regionally integrated. Everybody talks about Israel's regional integration, but Gaza has been isolated between Israel on one side and the Egyptians on the other. 70% of Gazans have not left the coastal enclave. And so when you talk about the process of de-radicalization, you can't just lecture people and de-radicalize them. It's a process. It's inspiring. It's empowering through jobs, through progress, through reimagining what their lives could be like, and through civil society, through nation, and moving away from the resistance narrative toward the nation-building narrative. And so I see the potential now amidst the sheer destruction for that to be realized. My concern, however, is what Robert raised, which is that, yes, you're going to have a hard time having a force going in there with what I perceive. I mean, I don't want a UNIFIL 2.0, and I'm referring here to the useless UN peacekeeping mission in southern Lebanon that failed to disarm Hezbollah, and actually Hezbollah quadrupled in strength. That's not what we need, because Hamas is going to be able to rebuild and recycle all the destroyed materials into armaments. So there's a missing link here. And I think the only ones, other than the Israelis, that can organically take the fight to Hamas and gradually degrade it are other Palestinians. And that's where the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian clans, elements of them, under a unified umbrella, not under the horrible plan that Prime Minister Netanyahu tried of bribing the heads of some clans to work with them. That's where I think the force can protect civilians, but an auxiliary component can be maybe a private force can train locals, etc., the Palestinian Authority. So like, I want outside of the box thinking instead of the same old recycled tired talking points. And yes, I care about two states. I am a two-stater. But if we just keep thinking about the two-state binaries through Hamas is gone, and now we're going to bring in Fatah and the PA, and that's somehow going to solve things in Gaza or initiate the aforementioned transformation, then we're in for a rude awakening. So maybe President Trump can, in fact, actually have a role in that. I worry, however, that the enthusiasm may subside now that Israeli hostages are finally out of the Gaza dungeons, and that maybe he'll just move on to the next war that he's interested in stopping so that he gets his Nobel Peace Prize.
John Lindzen, last month you were in New York on the sidelines of the annual opening of the UN General Assembly. Mm-hmm. You were among those who participated in this Franco-Saudi initiative for a two-state solution, all this, these talks. Listening there to Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, do you see leadership capable of thinking outside the box among the Palestinians?
Yes. I mean, I think we need to see the election inside Palestine that President Abbas pledged to President Macron as part of this sort of New York Declaration framework. In the elections that were cancelled a few years ago, many friends of mine were running for office. They quit their jobs. They paid this very, very high deposit. There is no shortage of ambitious, talented, dynamic young Palestinians that want to do public service and national leadership. There's just simply been no mechanism or opportunity for longer than the average median lifespan of a Palestinian. So we have to see that renewal take place. And it's worthwhile, again, I don't want to sound like the overly optimistic person on the panel. Next year, it's probable that we will have elections in both Israel and Palestine for the first time. It's also probable, looking at polls, that we have a changing of leadership in both societies. And you have new ideas coming to the fore, to Ahmed's point. We have to see these out-of-the-box ideas developed, but also picked up by politicians. And what I saw today in Israel was a real vibe shift. I mean, I spent a lot of the day on the phone to my Israeli friends, and it was a moment of real hope and optimism, yes, with the release of the hostages, but also the use of the word peace for the first time in a very, very long time in the Israeli public discourse inside the Knesset. I didn't love everything that I heard, but from a purely Israeli perspective, what you saw was a change in mood. And, you know, we've seen precedents for this before. When Anwar Sadat made his historic visit to Jerusalem in 1977, he arrived into an Israel where only 30% of people believed peace with Egypt was possible. And by the time he left, 90% of Israelis believed peace was possible. So that one visit, the choreography of it, the ability to change the sort of the mood music on the street in Israel is important, because The majority of the power and the agency to shift events lies inside the state of Israel. It's by far the more powerful of the two parties. There is an ability, I think, for Israel to be able to reach out to the wider region that never existed before. And if not now, when? I mean, we've just lived through the worst 2 years in the region's history. And if we've a choice between going back to that, to the probability of violence, or to try and find a diplomatic framework that can inspire young people, we did a poll a few weeks ago. We found, for the first time in a very long time, young Israelis, 18 to 24-year-old Israelis, were moving in support of diplomacy and a regional two-state solution. We've heard for decades the Israeli youth were moving to the right, and we're now seeing a swing taking place in the final stages of this war.
All right, Noga Tarnopovsky, which vibe did you feel on this day? Because there's what John's describing, and there's the images we were fed of standing ovations in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, for Donald Trump. Trump, who at one point turns to the president of Israel and suggests pardoning Netanyahu, who's on trial for corruption. Which vibe did you feel? Because Benjamin Netanyahu's proved to be the ultimate political survivor.
And far be it from me to, doubt his abilities as a magician in Israeli politics. but he is in a bit of a corner despite the ecstasy of today for him. And what you describe, the scenes in the Knesset, but I should add, those scenes were very engineered scenes. The Knesset that is run by Prime Minister Netanyahu's majority party didn't even let families of hostages who wanted to thank Donald Trump into the public. They let only a handpicked very few family members who are supporters, public supporters of the Prime Minister in. They really seeded the entire plenum with party activists and personal friends of the Prime Minister. So these scenes of, you know, that felt like a campaign rally of people screaming Netanyahu's name, Bibi, and even some of the applause for Trump was very much planned, and it was planned for the reason that Netanyahu wanted to show Trump a different image than the dismal one from two nights ago, Saturday night, the vast rally in Tel Aviv, and when Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, spoke, 100,000 people booed Netanyahu. That image was seen in the White House, and Netanyahu was willing to go to great lengths today to undo it. On the other hand, I would say the vast relief that swept over Israel today, not just in Hostages Square, where there were around 65,000 people today, but really all over the country, because each of these hostages comes from a different place, from Jerusalem, from Carmel, up on the border with Lebanon, from the south, from the kibbutzim. So all over the country, you saw gatherings and really a sense of relief. I think many Israelis genuinely feared that these hostages would never be seen alive. And that was genuine. That was not engineered. And we find ourselves in the gap, asking the question, where does Netanyahu stand? Where is he placed? We're in the gap between those two things. I will say that there are some problems looming for him. One is exactly what Ahmed was talking about. Images of Hamas militants, armed militants, executing, summarily executing perceived opponents in the Gaza Strip belies Netanyahu's promise that Hamas would be finished, would be destroyed. This puts the lie both to claims of a military destruction of Hamas and certainly to Netanyahu's constant promise that he would remove any threat from Hamas forever, demolish the organization. That is one problem. The other problem looming for him is the fact that we have no idea and there's no mechanism in place to ensure the demilitarization of Hamas, and that is not an easy problem to fix. And finally, another problem, another obstacle that arose today already, which is Hamas was committed by the terms of the Trump agreement to release all of the dead hostages today as well. It did say ahead of time that it didn't know where all of those 28 bodies were located, but the expectation is that at least 20 coffins would cross the border today, and only four have, and only four did after Israel protested. So we're already seeing a situation in which Israel is claiming a breach of the agreement, and there's no mechanism in place to enforce it or even to adjudicate it. So I think that once the ecstasy of today passes, Netanyahu is likely to find himself still in trouble with the Israelis.
Noga, you talk about ecstasy. Tell our viewers exactly where you are and what that boisterous singing we can hear behind you.
I'm in Hostage Square, where I've been since 5 this morning. And what is happening now is that the big crowd, the regulars here, the supporters of the families of hostages, some actual family members of hostages, this whole institution that has come into being the last 2 years has begun to fade. All of these people have started to go home. But tonight is the beginning of a Jewish festival day of Simchat Torah. And what we see here are groups of young religious kids, really kids, maybe 16 or 15, who have come, instead of celebrating this festival in a synagogue like they normally would, are celebrating here, turning this public plaza into a sort of open-air synagogue, and really rejoicing here very, very loudly, and other people are joining in with them.
All right. It's been a day of emotions, as we said, sadness for some, a lot of celebrations for others. And we saw a lot of victory laps from the U.S. president throughout these 2 years. It's been alleged that Benjamin Netanyahu forced Donald Trump's hand, particularly with the bombing of Iran. So it was interesting to hear the U.S. president kind of playfully needle Netanyahu during that speech before the Knesset.
We make the best weapons in the world, and we've got a lot of them. And we've given a lot to Israel, frankly. And I mean, Bibi would call me so many times, can you get me this weapon, that weapon, that weapon? Some of them I never heard of, Bibi, and I made them. But we'd get them here, wouldn't we?
Robert Satloff, listening to that, what is the relationship going forward between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, the clip you just played and the clip which also was during the speech where the president says, you know, Netanyahu is a tough guy to deal with, but that's what makes him great. This is music to Netanyahu's electoral ears. This is precisely the sort of candidate he believes the Israeli people will vote again to the prime ministry. Again, a candidate who is tough, who's not easy to deal with, but in the end gets his way with the most important person in the world, the president of the United States. And polls being what polls are, Netanyahu has his eye on the one poll that matters, which is the electoral vote. And he thinks he can get reelected despite everything that happened before October 7th, despite everything that has happened since. And who knows? It's not impossible. So that's the relationship he loves to have. Not an easy partner, but one in the end that earned the respect of the colossus that is Donald J. Trump. And so I think we saw that on full display today. To me, it's a regret that Netanyahu did not go to Sharm el-Sheikh. He was invited at the last minute by President Sisi via a telephone call that Donald Trump arranged. He loves to do this. He arranged that telephone call between Netanyahu and the Emir of Qatar. And then he arranged a phone call between the president of Egypt, with whom who hasn't spoken to Netanyahu in years, and to secure an invitation. Regrettably, Netanyahu declined. It's quite odd to think that there was an entire Middle East peace conference to which the Israeli prime minister was not a party, but yet that was his own decision. But that's the relationship he has with Donald Trump, one in which he likes being the tough guy that in the end Trump respects.
So you hear it, John Linden, don't write off Netanyahu yet.
No, I mean, you'd be a fool to. He's one of the most talented politicians I've ever seen, and he's the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history. But, you know, the polls today suggest that people are hungry for new leadership. I think also Robert's point about the spurning of the invitation today is important, because Donald Trump engineered that call. President Sisi paid a political price by making the invitation, and Prime Minister Netanyahu decided not to go. And in microcosm, that may indicate a dynamic that we'll see more and more in the coming months, where Prime Minister Netanyahu continues to move at a very slow pace on implementation of what is in this 20-point plan, continues to embarrass or annoy President Trump about his dealings with the other multilateral partners, whether Arab or European, that have been brought together, and you see in Sharm el-Sheikh. And as President Trump said today to Bibi, you can't fight the world. And I think Netanyahu, is part of his political profile in Israel is that he stands up to everybody, that he's stubborn and indignant and drags his heel and will not allow the establishment of a Palestinian state. But the entire world, with the exception of the Islamic Republic of Iran and this current Israeli government, agree on the need for a two-state solution. And so this kind of fly in the ointment, that everything that we see around the longer-term implementation of what's being discussed, if Prime Minister Netanyahu ends up being the kind of stick in the gears for that, I can imagine it leading to more difficult moments with President Trump, particularly if he wants that Nobel Peace Prize next October.
Yeah, and to keep the eye of the international community on the ball, there's the question of how you maintain the momentum here. When he landed in Egypt, France's president, and the UK prime minister, flanking Mahmoud Abbas, who was invited to the ceremony after being barred from attending the opening of the UN General Assembly last month in New York. When asked if his pressure to work on the day after scenarios had rubbed off on Donald Trump, Emmanuel Macron pointed to last week's conference that he hosted here in Paris.
This is to ensure that we have a governance framework that allows the Palestinians to have their share in the governance of Gaza, but which also ensures the political perspective for the day after, which is at the heart of the Franco-Saudi initiative and peace plan. It is to make the link between Gaza and the West Bank, which we must not forget on this day. And it is to ensure that there is a path to enable the two-state solution, which is the only political perspective that truly allows for lasting peace.
Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib, any of this possible if Donald Trump gets distracted or becomes more interested in something else?
Well, not only is it questionable due to Trump's own engagements and other political affairs around the world, but I think it's time to acknowledge that there are structural challenges that are taboo to discuss, but need to be brought to the fore, if you will. And, you know, this issue of connecting Gaza to the West Bank, I understand it as a broad political concept, but it's time to acknowledge that Gaza and the West Bank are fundamentally different. And this idea that the Palestinian Authority in its current shape and form is going to parachute into Gaza and reestablish dominion, both political, societal, financial, and security, to somehow integrate the two territories as part of a Palestinian state that was acknowledged last month, I don't know that that's really the best way to move forward. I think right now there needs to be a focus on nurturing organic talents within Gaza. As John said, there's no shortage of Palestinian engineers, academics, journalists, poets, technocrats, professors of all types and ages, an entire class of professionals who are ready to rise up. I want to see infrastructure by that the French, the Canadians, the UK, and certainly President Trump, with his entrepreneurial spirit, invest in creating space for nurturing that talent and bringing them up and really empowering them, so that they are part of the new generation of Palestinian political leadership. They are part of a new polity that can actually rise up. You know, yesterday I was looking at images of Palestinian Authority, like an impressive convoy of a PA police force, which, by the way, I support the PA in a lot of ways. I think they're, I wish they would take over in Gaza. It's like, I'm pragmatic that way. However, they had every single one of them had a Palestinian flag. Every single one of the convoy trucks had a bunch of these, you know, decked out police officers. They had a Palestinian flag, and then they had a flag of Fatah, the yellow flag of the political party. Like, why? We're building state institutions. We're not building a nation for Fatah. We're not building a nation for a certain political party. No, we're building a nation for all Palestinians. And so that's my concern, is that there's all this nice sounding talk that, you know, and maybe Trump, as a deal maker, as an outside of the box thinker, maybe he sees through that. Maybe he acknowledges that with the Israeli settlements, with the Israeli intransigence on some of those issues, you can't really negotiate that question with the old frameworks. The question is, can there ever really be durable peace if you just focus on Gaza but ignore the military occupation of the West Bank, ignore the expansion of the illegal settlements? What does that look like to have some piece of Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank if we know that de facto annexation is already, like, it's already taking place? So that's where I am hoping that it's not just keeping President Trump engaged with old ideas that, quite frankly, many of our European friends keep bringing to the table. But maybe there really is, now is the time to keep him engaged by presenting the idea of the younger generation having a seat at the table, or a new federated model between Gaza and the West Bank. Maybe a Gaza first. I am, by the way, not just because I'm from Gaza, but I've seen the emergence of a concept among a small network of Palestinians, and I'm certainly a champion of this, a Gaza-first approach. And it's not the Palestinian equivalent of MAGA. It is simply to say that we've wasted 20 years since the 2005 disengagement and withdrawal of Israeli settlements. And so why not focus on Gaza, rejuvenate it, revitalize it, make it a crown jewel of the Palestinian people and an effective role model of self-governance and an example of what an occupation-free West Bank will look like. That way we can show that, yes, the last 20 years have entailed tens of thousands of lives lost, tens of billions of dollars and aid money wasted for nothing, but finally, we are shifting course. Our people are moving towards the coexistence and nation-building narrative, and you, President Trump, can have a major role in making that a reality.
All right, we're unfortunately out of time, so I'm going to ask a quick final word from Noga Tarnopovsky in Tel Aviv. Noga, is there a feeling that the conversation has shifted, as was predicted 2 years ago when the guns would go silent?
There is a feeling that the conversation could shift, I would say. We really are on the cusp. You know, it is true that today the words peace were heard in the public space for the first time in a very long time in Tel Aviv and in the Knesset. It is also true that President Trump is the first person to mention the rights of Palestinians and the aspiration of Palestinians in the Knesset, at least in the last two decades. And Prime Minister Netanyahu's extremist ministers sat and took it. So we may be seeing a paradigm shift, but it really, you know, so much is at stake right now. And the fact that there is no enforcement mechanism, the fact that everyone is in a bit of an anarchy right now, does feel like we're still living in a question mark.
All right, a question mark after what's been a momentous day. Noga Tarnopovsky in Tel Aviv, Ahmed Fuad Al-Khatib and Robert Satloff in Washington. John Linden, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.